morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Russia-Africa summit starts today, but what is Africa asking for?
They need to be clear that they should be taken seriously and that they cannot continue to be pawns, but they must stop behaving like pawns. They must also be very clear that there will be certain battles that they will not be part of.
South Africa's opposition protest law that encourages race quotas for management positions. Liberians decry hardship as the country celebrates 176 years of independence. The UN Human Rights Committee condemns Uganda's anti-homosexuality law. Resident doctors in Nigeria go on strike for better pay and working conditions.
About 13 years ago, when I was doing my internship in Lagos, my salary was $1,000. Now, fast forward 2023, the highest of a doctor cannot boast of $1,000 as take-home salary.
And a high-level delegation from Guinea's National Front for the Defense of the Constitution visits the United Nations. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An academic and political analyst says African leaders should demand to be taken seriously and not treated like pawns on the international stage. At the same time, Professor Sipo Sipi, a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand, says African leaders should make clear that there are certain battles that they will not be part of. This as the second Russia-Africa summit gets underway today, Thursday, in St. Petersburg, Russia, against the backdrop of the Ukraine war. Professor Sipi tells me that African leaders should seek mutually beneficial relations and not to be used as proxies in other countries' battles.
Africa is a beggar in international relations, whether it's with the EU or with the U.S., and Africa is mired in conflicts. There's a lot of poverty. And now with the Ukraine and the Russia conflict, you also have a challenge with regard to grain and also fertilizers. So for them, the position is that, yes, we understand that there's a conflict, but we are here to also pursue our interest. So what you have here is a convergence of interest. One, Africa is interested in being bailing out of its conditions that are challenging for its population. At the same time, Russia needs a form of a friend who are maybe understanding and who may be sympathetic to its position and interest.
Professor, there are some people who are arguing whether African countries should attend the summit at all, because they say, after all, African countries went to Russia on a peace mission. And what did they get?
Yeah.
Russia pulled out of the Ukraine Green Deal and began bombing Ukraine green facilities. So they are saying, is it necessary at all to go there?
Look, countries will always look towards what's in it for them. But when you allow yourself to be played, then you find yourself hustling between one major capital to another. Because if the U.S. were to say, I would like to have a U.S.-Africa meeting, the very same leaders would be rushing in a bus to go to that meeting. Now we see them in a state where they are also considering going to Russia again. And with Russia, it's also what you call emotional connection, that Russia was not a major player during what you call the oppression of African countries. It was out there, and it did provide some support of sorts, both politically and also in terms of weaponry. But beyond that, the relationship with the West, with African countries, is much more stronger. So they need to ask themselves again, whose pawns are we going to be? Or put differently, can we reach a stage where we look first at the African interest and see who might be the best person to work, and or how do we balance the relationship with these superpowers?
Talking about interest, Professor, I think it was, well, what, 2 weeks ago that Kenyan President William Ruto hosted the African Union mid-year coordination meeting in Nairobi. One of the speakers there, I think it was the UN representative, made it clear the need for African leaders to speak with one voice. What one voice or message do you think African leaders should take to this Russia-Africa summit?
Well, if they go there, they need to be clear that they should be taken seriously and that they cannot continue to be pawns, but they must stop behaving like pawns. And one of the interesting things is that they must also be very clear that there'll be certain battles that they will not be part of, and they will not allow themselves to be hoodwinked. But they can have a relationship that are mutually beneficial.
Professor Sipho Sipi is a political analyst and former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. You are speaking with me from Johannesburg. South Africa's main opposition party protested on Wednesday against a new law that allows racial quotas in the workplace. The government believes quotas are needed to level the economic playing field for black South Africans. The opposition says the law will discriminate against minority whites, Indians, and mixed-race people. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
Hundreds took to the streets in Cape Town on Wednesday to demonstrate against a new law that allows racial quotas in the workplace. Protester Astrid Ann Abrams is part of the mixed-race minority group classified in South Africa as coloured.
A lot of people not working, and now they still want to marginalise us, coloureds and whites and Indians.
The South African government says the law is necessary because most companies are not following through on pledges to transform their workforce by hiring more qualified black South Africans. While black people make up an estimated 4/5 of South Africa's over 60 million people, the latest employment equity report from the government shows they hold only 16.9% of top management positions. Protester Topelo Mokati, a Democratic Alliance councillor in the city of Cape Town who is classified as black, says the existing employment equity legislation in place since 1998 obviously hasn't worked for everyone.
Instead, we have found that there's a certain grouping that benefited, the small elite grouping.
Earlier this year, President Cyril Ramaphosa signed into law the amendment to the Employment Equity Act of 1998, giving the Minister of Employment the power to set what are called targets for certain sectors. It will affect companies that employ more than 50 people. Such companies must ensure within 5 years that they meet targets which are aimed at boosting black representation in positions that require specialized skills, professional degrees, or management responsibilities. The details of which targets will be set for which sector and province were open to public comment and are still being finalized. Labour lawyer Puke Maseru Mule says it's good to have laws, but government must work to ensure compliance.
And of course, on the part of employers, we also need implement, you know, perhaps willingly without legal duress. Because let's be honest, I think it's in the interest of everybody, of the economy, of black, white, yellow, green, that we don't have the level of differentiated incomes and poverty that we have. It's just a recipe for disaster.
The opposition Democratic Alliance says the law will inevitably cost some people their jobs based on skin color. The Director of Employment Equity in the Department of Labor, Ntsoaki Mamashila, says no one will lose their job so that companies can meet the targets. But she says companies that do not comply or have a valid reason for not complying will be taken to the labor court and could be fined up to 2% of their annual revenue. Mamashila says a nationwide campaign is underway to explain the amendments to workers and bosses. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
The 18-member UN Human Rights Committee has condemned Uganda's Anti-Homosexuality Act and urged the government to quickly repeal it. Uganda was one of 7 countries examined by the committee, which monitors implementation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In releasing its final observations, the committee expressed deep concern about the discriminatory nature of the act, saying it stigmatizes and persecutes people based on their sexual and gender identity. The committee said it has received reports of hate speech, outings, and violence against LGBTI people in Uganda, as well as arbitrary arrests of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex persons based on the Penal Code Act and the Anti-Homosexuality Act. Vice Chair of the committee, Jose Santos Pais, said he was appalled by the content and impact of the law and called on the government to address this issue.
And particularly to repeal the Anti-Homosexuality Act and Section 145 of the Penal Code to end the criminalization of consensual sexual relations between adults of the same sex. This act foresees, for instance, death penalty for serial homosexuality.
The last time the committee reviewed Uganda's human rights record was 19 years ago. After this inordinately long delay, Uganda appeared before the committee with a large 15-person high-powered delegation of government officials. Pais said the Ugandan delegation sought to justify the Anti-Homosexuality Act based on cultural values and on the position of most people toward homosexuality, which it claimed was generally opposed to same-sex relationships.
It was, if I recall correctly, particularly stressed that this was a decision of the legitimate authorities of Uganda. And so they have taken their stand. They will bear the responsibilities for that. We're not convinced by those arguments, of course, but that's how it goes.
Among its recommendations, the committee called on the Ugandan government to amend the Equal Opportunities Commission Act to prohibit sexual orientation and gender identity as grounds for discrimination. It also urged the government to address discriminatory attitudes and stigma towards LGBTI persons among government officials and the public through comprehensive awareness raising and other sensitization activities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 27th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th. Help us celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076. Once again, +1 202 258 3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a particular news story that you connected with. Recall a favorite memory about VOA Africa and tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. Once again, the WhatsApp number is +1 202 258 3076. And we thank you for 60 years of support. The Nigeria Association of Resident Doctors Wednesday began an indefinite strike. The doctors say they have presented several issues over pay and working conditions to the government without receiving an invitation for dialogue. Our reporter in Nigeria spoke with some Nigerians about the strike.
The doctors say they began the strike because the government failed to meet their demands, which includes payment of salary arrears, hazard allowance, and the replacement of doctors who leave the country to work overseas. The strikers also want an improvement of facilities in state-run hospitals across the country. A public servant, Mary Oko, supports the Association of Resident Doctors Industrial Action, which affects all government hospitals. They account for about one-third of all doctors in the country.
I think the strike action by the resident doctors is a good development because they've been on this for so long, and it seems as though the government doesn't understand any other thing other than protest or strike actions.
Lecturer Oche Akase also welcomes the strike.
If these bodies are saying you need to pay them for the work that they are doing, why not? If 70 million can be given as palliatives to House of Rest members and 40 million for cars, come on, what are we talking about? If you check it, what these doctors are asking for might not even be up to that.
70 million naira equals about $88,000. A senior registrar for the Resident Doctors Department of Family Health in Zaria, Nigeria, who asked to remain anonymous, decried the poor living conditions for doctors in the country.
I could remember about 18 years ago when I was doing my internship in Lagos. My salary, that is the lowest cadre of being a medical doctor, that's housemanship. My salary was $1,000 then. That was 165,000 naira. Now, fast forward 2023, the highest cadre of a doctor, which is a consultant, cannot boast of $1,000 as take-home salary. That speaks volume.
He says the strike would last until the government is ready to meet their terms.
There's no way any sane doctor can afford to work in this climate at the moment. It's not possible. It's not just possible. All our demands must be met. And our demands are simple. There should be a pay rise, 200% pay rise. We're also demanding for every doctor that leaves, there should be a replacement.
Senior resident doctors earn about $625, while junior doctors earn $375. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
A high-level delegation from the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, FNDC, of Guinea, led by the group's national coordinator, has been holding discussions at the United Nations. The FNDC and the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, are pressing the military junta, led by Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, to return Guinea to democratic rule. The military has banned the FNDC for allegedly organizing armed demonstrations. Alpha Freya Barry is the founding member of the FNDC. He tells me the delegation has been explaining its proposals for overcoming the crisis in Guinea, emphasizing the importance of an inclusive and peaceful dialogue.
This does serve to acknowledge and appreciate all contribution and moral support in the pursuit of establishing democracy and the rule of law.
There is a transition process going on in Guinea. What's the view of the FNDC on the progress of the transition?
To answer that question, I just have to tell you that the transition is not on the right path.
What do you mean the transition is not on the right path?
It means too simply that the transition is triggered, is blocked.
An ECOWAS delegation has been visiting Guinea, and I think ECOWAS has said that the military junta should stick to the 24-month transition process. Are you saying that it's not working or that would not be possible?
When the ECOWAS obtained that agreement with the authority, since then, nothing is made by the authority like to make people believe that we're going back to the normal situation. On that agreement, they maintained 10 points. But among those 10 points, even 1 point, they don't achieve anything. They just keep playing games with the people. And even with the ECOWAS, because when they obtained the 24 months, the ECOWAS asked government to create conditions that's going to allow all the people that are concerned on this situation to come back together around the table and to create a condition, a secure condition. Among those, a lot of people are outside of the country. Another people are in jail. Even our head in the FNDC, he was in jail for 9 months. And to let him get out from the jail, we have to protest.
I want to talk about the dialogue, because part of the transition process is a dialogue among political parties. How does the FNDC see the dialogue? Is it going according to plan?
In our case, when I say our case, I talk about Guinea. The dialogue is not between the political parties. There is one article, the document, which said the dialogue should be between the political party and the new authority. That's the article 77. And then you have two branches of political party. You have all the big parties in the country who are not associated to the dialogue, because what the biggest party and the civil society ask the new authority, even the ECOWAS, the UN, the European Union, and all those big organizations, is to allow Guinea to create a dialogue between those big parties and the civil society and the new authority. But that dialogue, that table, will be led by the ECOWAS in presence of the big institution. But the government, they don't do that. They just make it seem like we have dialogue.
Alpha Freya Barre is a founding member of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, FNDC, of Guinea. He was speaking with me from New York State. Some regions in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo are experiencing a food crisis due to insecurity. In Goma, for example, all supply roads have been cut off by the M23 rebels, a situation that is driving up food prices. To solve this problem, a young entrepreneur has created Kivu Labor, a project which aims to produce several tons of agricultural products, thanks to the labor offered by displaced people. Reporter Zaneb Neti Zaide has more from Goma.
Even if the work in the fields is difficult, these displaced people always do it in a good atmosphere. They include Mareba Alphonsine. She is a displaced woman and mother of nine who lives in Kanyaruchinya camp for IDPs north of Goma. She's one of many who were selected to cultivate and then feed the city and the surrounding area. For her, the work comes at just the right time. She says the project in Seattle came to look for them at the site for internally displaced people and gave them 5,000 Congolese francs, about $2. So they are cultivating in the hope of having enough to feed their children. The project in question is Kivu Labour. It was begun by young Omwinja Manasseh, who wants to solve the shortage of food in the markets of Goma and the surrounding area during this time of war. With over 8 hectares of arable land, this young entrepreneur in just 4 months could help feed hundreds of hungry people. He says he noticed that food prices were increasing. Beans used to cost 1,000 Congolese francs, about 40 US cents. Today, they cost 5,000 Congolese francs, or $2. And a kilo of potatoes used to cost 500 Congolese francs, or 20 cents. Today, a kilo costs 2,000 francs, or 82 cents. So, as a young entrepreneur, he wanted to solve the problem through agriculture, which is why he mobilized people to support him. This approach is supported by economic specialists. Deo Bengehia is a professor of economics at universities in the region. He says that the Congolese government should support local agriculture and help to reduce the food crisis in war-torn region. He says the city of Goma is suffering because of the economic stagnation affecting the country in general, and the effects of the war in particular. This initiative is to be encouraged. It could resolve the situation, at least somewhat. At least, he says, it's an important first step. Omunja Manasseh recruits more than 100 displaced people a day and gives them a small amount of money to cultivate and sow. But to make real progress, he will still need more outside support. For VOA Africa, I'm Zanem Nitizaidi in Goma.
And that's it for this Thursday, July 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton in Washington saying, have a great day and please be safe, whatever you do.